I'm pulling out of my driveway. We all know what that means. It's time for another drive to work. Okay, so last time I started talking about the top 20 worst mechanics based on a speech I gave at MagicCon Las Vegas 2024. So last time I got through the first seven. So we're up to number 13, or first six, I think. We're up to number 13, I believe. So last time it was Stickers, Megamorph, Companion, Haunt, Annihilator, Devoid, Partner. And today we get to number 13, Miracle. So Miracle was a mechanic in Avacyn Restore. The idea of Miracle is when you draw a Miracle, the turn you draw it, it has a special Miracle cost that you could cast it for less. So the idea is you can cast it for less the turn you draw it. So the interesting story here is, this goes way back, when I was working on my very first set that I led, Tempest, Richard Garfield and I were playing around with the idea of draw triggers. So imagine having a card that does damage to somebody, and it's very efficient, but it does damage to me when I draw it. And so the idea, and it could be a positive, maybe you gain life when you draw it. The idea is, it just, the act of drawing it triggers and does something. And we thought that was really cool. There were a lot of fun designs. The problem was, if it's a digital game, it'd be fine. The computer could track it. But okay, I draw this thing. How does my opponent know I drew it? You know, how do they know? And it's like, and the worst is, let's say it's bad for me. Let's say it's one of these direct damage spells where it damages me. And I'm at 2 life, and it is 2 damage to me. Now, if I'm an honest player, I go, oh, I guess I lost the game. But a slightly less scrupulous player might just go, oh, I'll just hide this information. I won't cast it, because if I cast it, they'll know I have it. But I just will never cast it, and they'll never know. And one of the things about making mechanics is you have to assume that people won't always be honest about things. You want to make sure that there's, you know, we don't want to make a system where honest people play it fairly and then dishonest people just cheat with it because there's no way to monitor it. And we tried a bunch of things. We tried a version where it was voluntary whether you showed it, so it was only upside and not downside. But anyway, we abandoned it. We ended up doing other things. And from time to time, we get a new designer in the building, and they go, ooh, draw triggers, and they would try to do draw triggers. So anyway, this was Brian Tinsman's turn to do draw triggers, but he found a way to do it. So the way he did it was, it cared about the turn you drew it. Now, the problem, this is why it's on the list, is in order for you to show that what I need to do is I need to draw the top card, look at it without it yet being in my hand, and then I can say to my opponent, you see, I picked the card, I haven't put it in my hand yet, I can now reveal it to you, and you know that it's off the top of my library because I haven't yet put it in my hand, right? But what that meant was, in order to play this card, you had to sort of change how you drew from the deck. And it gets even worse than that. Let's say, for example, you're not even playing with miracles in your deck, but you don't want your opponent to know you're not playing with miracles. So there's this incentive to draw that way, even if you don't care about the mechanic. And it was, once again, I talked a lot about logistics. Like, right, it's not the mechanic in a vacuum. I think if this was a only online mechanic, it's not that bad. Like, it's a cool mechanic. I actually like the mechanic. I think there's nothing wrong with draw triggers from a pure gameplay standpoint. It's interesting. There's deck building. I mean, there's neat things to it. The problem is that there's no way to monitor it. And the way to make it work in this case is at least doable, unlike some of the stuff Richard and I were doing. Richard and I did toy with an idea for a while of just changing the back of the card so they had a different back, because this is before sleeves, or before opaque sleeves. Anyway, so that is why it's on my list. Not because it's not inherently a fun mechanic, not because people might not enjoy it. There's the classic Pro Tour where Miracle saved the day. I mean, there's fun things that can happen with it. The thing that's bad about it, and the lesson here, is that you have to think about the impact on the rest of the game of your mechanics. And that if the mechanic does something as big as makes you change how you physically handle the cards, you really have to be wary of that. Like, what kind of gain are we getting? And the idea that you might make people have to draw differently, even if in their deck they're not even playing the mechanic, really speaks volumes to some of the trouble of it. So that was the miracle mechanic, and why it's on my list at number 13. Number 12, Forecast. So this was in Dissension. So Forecast was inspired by an Unglued card, of all things. So in Unglued, I made a card. What was the name of the card? It was Infernal Spawn of Evil. So the idea was, there was an artist named Ron Spencer that was drawing drawing art for a card that was like a mean, something mean. And he drew this cute little mouse drinking cocoa as a joke, as a like descendant for his sketch, just to ha-ha, and then here's my real sketch. I liked that sketch, so I decided that it'd be fun to make a card, get Ron Spencer to actually draw that picture, not to sketch it. And so the idea was, I loved the flavor of it, like playing into what he was doing. It's the cruelest creature you've ever imagined, except it looks like a little tiny mouse sipping cocoa. And so I wanted it to be really powerful. So I made this really expensive card, and when it came out, it was really scary. But I wanted it to do something. I didn't want, like, oh, you know, every once in a blue moon, we have lots of mana, you can cast it. So I gave it an ability, and once again, this is an unset, where you could pay mana, you could show it to your opponent, you had to say, it's coming. And the idea was, just knowing that it was out there, knowing that one day it would come, was so scary it made them lose life. That was the flavor. So anyway, I thought about that. So we were trying to do Azorius. This was in Dissension. We wanted to get the Azorius mechanic. And I liked the idea of a mechanic that worked in the hand. That was the idea. Oh, imagine you have cards that had an ability that you could activate in your hand, and they did a small ability. The idea was the forecast ability would be something small, and then when you cast the card, it did something bigger, but that was synergistic with what you were doing with the forecast ability. So basically what we ended up finding out was, A, it's the design space is narrow. Like, I have to have a small effect that didn't work so well with the big effect when I cast the card. It also had a lot of other issues, like it's hard to interact with cards in hand. The only color really that can interact with it is black, because black has discard. I mean, blue and has a little bit of counter and activation, but we don't do a lot of that. So it was hard to interact with. There wasn't a lot of design space, and it ended up being just a little bit clunkier. I think there are... It's just one of those things that's, like, sometimes you come up with an idea, and in execution... I'm sorry, in... concept is a really cool idea, but in execution it is not. Another classic example of this might be like Suspend, where the idea of spending time for like, oh, instead of spending mana, I'm spending time. That is a really cool concept. The problem is it like takes four lines of text to explain what it is, and there's a lot of bookkeeping, and there's just a lot you have to do. And so one of the things you have to be careful about when making it is thinking about the practicality of it, not just the concept of it. I think Forecast is cool in concept, but it's just not that cool in actual practice. Okay, next up, Initiative, number 11. So Initiative first showed up in Commander Legends Battle for Baldur's Gate. So there had previously been a Dungeon Dragon set, Adventures in Forgotten Realm, where you could go to a dungeon, venture into a dungeon, and there were three different dungeons. And so the idea for this set was they decided they were going to make sort of an extension of that. So the idea of Initiative is you went into a particular dungeon, and then the idea was you would advance in a dungeon you're already in, or if you weren't in a dungeon, you go in this particular dungeon. And this particular dungeon made sense with Battle for Baldur's Gate and stuff like that. Anyway, so here's interesting with this mechanic. The mechanic for its intended use is fine. It was made for Commander play, and here's a fun thing, and I don't think it's getting abused in Commander play, to the best of my knowledge. The problem is that when we make Magic cards, other formats get to use it. And it turns out that Initiative just gives you too much value in a place where you can take advantage of it in a way that you can't really in a Commander game. And so it turns out that in formats like Vintage, and this is one of the challenges, and one of the hard things is when we make cards for Magic, we make cards for Magic and do whatever you want to do with them. And so this is a good example of we made a mechanic for one place that ended up being broken in another place. That it turns out when you have access to sort of more resources and you can get there faster and you can do things to get through the dungeon faster, it just gives you a lot of kind of free resources in a way that when we were testing it for Commander didn't come up. Commander is not as fast. Like, there's just a lot of component pieces why it wouldn't matter in Commander, but it would matter in something like Vintage. And that's one of the things to be careful of is we made, and the funny thing is, it didn't see a lot of playing Commander, meaning the format it was meant to go in, it didn't have much impact. And then a format that was not at all, it has a lot of impact. And so that's one of the problems with it. And one of the signs of this is you have to be careful where and how your mechanics can be used. And one of the lessons, sort of the initiative lesson, is we have to keep an eye on all the major formats, because making something for one format but ignoring its impact in other formats, you have to be careful. And initiative is a really good example of something that's causing problem in a place that it was not at all designed for. Okay, that's number 11, initiative. Okay, number 10 is Cleave. So this is from Crimson Vow. So Cleave, there was text on the card, and if you pay the Cleave cost, you cleave the text from the card. It no longer has the text. And the idea is they would do cards that, like, you know, destroy all black creatures, but then you could cleave off the word black and destroys all creatures, stuff like that. Or destroy a creature with, you know, some restriction, but then you can cleave off the restriction. So where Cleave came from was, it actually came from Streets of New Capenna, of all places. So we were trying to figure out, there are five clans in Streets of New Capenna that are three-color arc clans, shard clans, and we were trying to figure out something, which one were we trying to figure out for? I think it was the Maestros, I think. But anyway, they were very clever. All of the different clans are based on different sort of criminal tropes from pop culture. And the smart criminals, that they execute very elaborate crimes and they think everything through. So the idea of having a mechanic that was like very clever and kind of very meta, like they're messing with the very cards that they're using, felt kind of cool. I believe Ari Nee came up with this mechanic. Anyway, Crimson Vow, so the Crimson Vow came out before Streets of New Capenna. They were looking for mechanics, and so they stumbled across this mechanic. And they said, could we take this mechanic? And we're like, okay, we have time to come up with other mechanics. And I don't even know whether or not we'd use Cleave in the set. But, so Cleave has a couple issues. Number one, I think it's a little backwards in how it functions, meaning I pay extra mana and I get rid of text. Is normally if you say, I'm going to make the spell better, you'd think getting rid of text makes it worse. That the idea that I'm getting rid of text and that improves the card is a little bit intuitively hard to wrap your brain around. The idea that it didn't do a great job of sort of getting the right feel. And there also is a separate problem that I'm not sure why Cleave was in Crimson Vow. Like, the reason we had it in Streets of New Capenna was it represents, like, this cool, meta, smart, clever thing. But that really wasn't what, it was the Vampire Wedding set. That was what was going on. So it kind of fell out of place. I think the execution of it was a little unintuitive in the nature of how it worked. And it was very hard to wrap your brain around to understand, like, what's going on. Like, if I cast a Cleave card and I paid the Cleave cost, I'm like, okay, so now you do the spell, but you don't have these texts. Like, it was really hard to understand what was happening. And I'm not sure. I mean, there's a number of factors here. I think it was a little too clever for its own good. It's definitely a mechanic that's kind of novel in that, oh, what am I doing? I'm removing text from the card. Like, there's something really clever about that, and that's fun. And the reason we were excited when we first saw it is, there's a novelty to it. There's something that's really different. But a couple things. One is, whenever you have novelty, use it in the right place. Novelty for the sake of novelty. Like, maybe there's a set where something like Cleave makes sense. Crimson Vow was not that set. So, first and foremost, I don't think it should be in Crimson Vow. Second, I think there needs to be a certain intuition to the card that people sort of grok what's going on. They understand what's going on. And there's something about the way that Cleave works that's just hard to wrap your mind around. I talked about Haunt last time, the stickiness. There's a little bit lack of stickiness here, and a little bit of just, it's not quite intuitively doing what you want. There is something weird about, I hack away text, and then the card gets better because I hack away text. That feels a little counterintuitive to that. So I'm not sure. I mean, I do think there's some kernel of a cool idea. I don't think the current execution is right, and I don't think Crimson Vow is the right set for it. So Cleave is number 10. Okay, next, number 9. Okay, so this was my catch-all. I called Unmemorable. I used multiple examples. I used Cohort, Conspire, Pack Tactics, Reinforce, and Support. And the idea was, I was using mechanics that just made people go, what was that mechanic again? And one of the hard things I realized now is I just wrote them down in front of me. Like all the other ones, I wrote down the name of the mechanic and just remind myself what set it's from. And I didn't write that down. And just off the bat, by the way, just a little side note of how hard it is. Like, Conspire, I know, was in Shadowmoor. It had to do with copying spells when you tap two creatures that share a color with the spell. And Pact Tactics was the only ability word in Adventures in Forgotten Realm that was full of flavor words and cared about you attacking with a certain amount of power creature. Reinforce was in Morningtide, and you could discard cards, kind of like cycling, but instead of drawing a card, you could get plus one counters. Support was the thing that added plus one counters to things, but originally, right before we were going to hand it off, it was also going to put on Planeswalker counters, but we removed it for, I don't even remember why we removed it. So these are abilities that, like, it's hard, you have to dredge up and remember where the ability comes from. So my point here was, we make a lot of cards in Magic, a lot of abilities in Magic, a lot of mechanics in Magic. And some of them are very flavorful, you know, cycling and kicker and flashback and landfall. And we make a lot of exciting mechanics that do really cool, memorable things. But sometimes we make a mechanic and it's like, And so this was kind of my catch-all. None of these felt worthy enough of being a whole category because they were just, it wasn't even that they're bad mechanics. It's just, they just didn't hit the bar that people could bother to remember them, which really is a sign that the mechanic isn't doing the work it needs to do. And different mechanics, like, support's a good mechanic where it kind of, if the last minute was changed, and we probably should have just de-keyworded it. Like, reinforce, I don't think reinforce, I think we made bad designs for reinforce. Maybe reinforce is something, but once again, it... Trading in your card for other cards is more universally useful than trading it for plus one counters. Maybe in the right set. So, anyway, the point of this whole category is, hey, we make a lot of mechanics. Some of the mechanics, the great crime of the mechanic is, it just didn't do anything that really caught attention to itself. It didn't break new ground. It didn't inspire. It's not, like I said, it's not even memorable. And that is pretty telling. When I name a mechanic, you're like, what did that do again? And you can't remember what it did. That is a sign that it is, that the mechanic on some level was not functioning as best it can. We make a lot of mechanics. Not that everybody needs to remember every mechanic. I get that. But what happened was, the reason that this category had up is, I was making a list, and I had a bunch of cards that were kind of unmemorable, and none of them wanted to make a slot, because I'm like, what am I going to say about it? It's like, yeah, well, it did this, and you know. And I finally decided that, it was okay for one thing to sort of collect a bunch of things just to sort of make the point. And really what the point I was making is that, hey, sometimes you just don't reach the bar. You just make something that's like, is that worth it? And oftentimes it's just not worth it. Okay, up next, at number 8, Epic. So Epic was, what was Epic? Epic was in Saviors of Kamigawa. I think it started because Brian Tinsman was trying to figure out a way to make legendary spells, is how it started. So Magic has had, since Legends, we've had legendary creatures and legendary lands. We've had legendary permanents. So I think legendary lands and legendary creatures, although they were creature-type legend at the time, not legendary, but those were introduced in Legends. We later got, you know, legendary artifacts and enchantments, and we really at the time hadn't done spells. Brian's like, I want to make a legendary instant or sorcery. What would that mean? That was his inspiration. So what it ended up coming with was actually... Actually, I think they ended up being enchantments, but anyway, what Epic says you can't cast spells for the rest of the game. Oh, sorry. First it says, every turn, do this effect. Every turn you get this effect. Well, that sounds pretty cool. But then you keep reading the card, and then it says, you can't cast any other spells ever. Like, wait. I like that I get the spell every turn, that's cool, but I can't cast spells ever again? Like, that is quite the downside. And one of the lessons of Magic, which is an important lesson, is I think a lot of Magic, we worry too much about this thing. We go, oh no, it might be a problem. And we kind of self-censor ourselves and we put on restrictions that in the end, we don't need. Like, there are restrictions that are less onerous than you can never cast a spell again for the rest of the game. Like, even if you limit it to once per turn, I mean, there's things you can do that actually mean something, you know, and... Epic is interesting in that it had one of the most exciting lines of text you'll read. You get to do this every turn for free. For free, every turn you get to do this. That's very exciting. followed by one of the most, like, horrible texts. And the lesson really there is, hey, can we salvage the really awesome text without having the really horrible text? Maybe we don't need the horrible text. And there's a lot of magic design. Like, early magic is really interesting. When you look at a lot of, like, the upkeeps and stuff, a lot of early magic, like, here's this giant creature, but you'll never play it because the upkeep isn't, you know. Like, even stuff like Lord of the Pit or Force of Nature, which were a little more on the better side of early magic, it's just, it is onerous to do that. And eventually we said, okay, let's stop doing all these. I mean, we do them every once in a rare moon, but let's stop it with it. Here's a giant creature, and this you have to do crazy things to keep it around, which aren't worth it. Oh, you want to attack with this serpent? Sack three islands. What? and so this is my sort of example, the reason I picked Epic is, it's not that it didn't have high aspirations. It's not that it didn't do cool things. It's not that there wasn't something really lovable about it. But I think the thing I said, so there's an expression I like, which says, if you put a thimble full of wine into a barrel full of sewage, you get sewage. And if you put a thimble full of sewage into a barrel full of wine, you get sewage. And the idea essentially there is a little bit of bad really muddies all the good. You can have a card that's so much good and so much exciting stuff. It doesn't take a lot of bad, just a little bit of bad to make that really exciting card not exciting anymore. And so that really, this really is the lesson of, you know, be careful. Like, if you're trying to make something exciting, hold back. Like, you know, and also a lot of times what we find when we play test stuff, sometimes things you think that are crazy overpowered aren't. And so what we've learned now is, hey, play the crazy version first. See how it plays. If it's too much, we'll pull back. But don't assume you have to pull back. Let's try the unfiltered version first to see how it plays. Because sometimes it's fun and it's not as onerous as you think. And all of a sudden, you know, in the olden times, you would have put a negative on it, makes people never play it, and you didn't even need the negative. Okay, that is Epic. Next, Fateful Hour. So Fateful Hour was from Dark Ascension. Okay, so the storyline of original Innistrad block is we come to Innistrad. We meet the monsters. They're vampires, werewolves, zombies, and spirits. And they're running havoc on the land. And the poor humans are terrified. Things are going bad for them. Well, Dark Ascension, the idea is things get even worse. The humans are on the last... Because obviously the third set, for those that don't remember, is Avacyn Restored. Liliana, through means, is going to release Avacyn, mostly to get a crystal brand, but Avacyn gets released, and because Avacyn gets released, she comes and the other angels save the day. So it's sort of the third act is like the humans are saved. So in order to make, like, we want the story to be as exciting as possible, the humans have to be in jeopardy. Well, they already started in jeopardy in Innistrad, but we have to get them to the brink. Like, the leader of their people, leader of their people, Micaeus, gets turned into a zombie! And so the idea is it's looking bleak. So I wanted to capture the bleakness of the people. And so the idea of the mechanic of Fateful Hour was that when you got to 5 or less life, these spells got more powerful. So they did a normal thing, but they did a more powerful thing if you're late at life. So the problem this ended up being is just a point in the game where I'm at 5 life but not dead is a very narrow point. Mostly because as the game progresses, your things rise. Then most of the time, if I'm at 5 life, my opponent's going to hit me and kill me in one turn. I'm not going to be plinked to 4, then plinked to 3. That's not usually what happens at the end of the game. So first and foremost, I picked a total that just the window for it happening was way, way too small. And, I mean, there's a little bit of maybe you want to get your own life down, but that's just so dangerous. So anyway, I made something that, just from a practicality standpoint, just didn't get much use. There wasn't a lot of time where you're at 5 or less life. The other thing was, like, one of the big lessons of that set was I spent so much time, like, capturing how horrible it was from the humans. And Tom Lapilli, who was the head developer of Dark Ascension, said to me, hey, shouldn't we play up the positive here? Like, yeah, the humans are in trouble, but you know who's having a great time? The monsters. And part of magic is, don't you want to tap into the fun part? Well, Dark Ascension wasn't about the plight of the humans. It was about the ruling of the monsters. Monsters are living big and living large and having a great time. And wouldn't it be fun to be a monster? And that inspired me to make the undying mechanic. So anyway, lesson there, first off, is I'm not sure how much we need to make mechanics that, like, show people suffering necessarily. That's not necessary to do that. But even then, even if we're trying to make something, it was kind of made, the idea originally was a catch-up feature. Like, okay, if I'm really low, this spell that maybe I play early in the game becomes all more powerful. And the idea behind it was, oh, we'll put it on the kind of spells that can help you catch up. And that was the, but in practicality, it both didn't come up enough, so it wasn't practical. And it's just kind of a depressing mechanic. It's like, oh, we're dying. Ooh, it's the we're dying mechanic. You know, it doesn't spark joy in anybody. And so we want to make sure our mechanics are doing that. We want to make sure the mechanics are making something that people are excited by. And so Fateful Hour just failed on that. Okay, next up. Number 6. Day-Night. Okay, so Day-Night was a mechanic in the Midnight Hunt. But it actually originated way back in original Innistrad. So when we were figuring out how to make werewolves work, we tried a bunch of different mechanics. One thing we tried was something akin to the day-night mechanic. But at the same time, we also tried double-faced cards, because Duel Master was doing double-faced. We make another game that's made mostly in Japan called Duel Masters. And Tom Lapilli, the one I just talked about being the head developer of Dark Ascension, was on the design team for Innistrad. And so he said, hey, here's this cool thing they do in this other game. Maybe we could do it here, because we had the ability to print double-sided cards, double-faced cards. And so we tried a bunch of different things. One of the things we tried was Day-Night. And Day-Night actually played interestingly, but double-faced cards were clearly the winner there. So we abandoned Day-Night for double-faced cards. We did take the essence of what we were doing with the werewolves and sort of make it into a mechanic on the werewolves. So there was a little bit of remnant of what we were doing with Day-Night, but we put onto the werewolves. So anyway, in Midnight Hunt, we were trying to sort of do something. And the idea was, well, what if we took the essence of what we were doing with werewolves and expanded out? What if night being night was scary, not just because of the werewolves becoming werewolves, but for other reasons? And like, you know, if we track day and night, just like the kind of you have to do for the werewolves, then what will happen is we can have other cards care about it. We give cards that like only come out at night or stronger at night or things that only come out in the day. We can make a lot of cards. We thought it was very flavorful. We thought it was fun. And we ended up matching exactly what we did with the werewolves to try to match it exactly. So a couple of problems happen. I think the biggest thing is when you make a mechanic, one of the things that you have to do with that mechanic is you want to make sure that it works well when you template it, when you make the rules for it. And so a lot of what goes on in later part of design is they put a mechanic through its paces. And one of the things you have to do is you have to actually write out the mechanic. How many words are on it? And one of the things that happens a lot when you write out the words is it's very long. So you start asking yourselves, hey, do we really need this or do we need that? So for example, early on, Day-Night actually had something that changed werewolves. It was kind of built into it. Okay, well, when it becomes night, anything that can become a werewolf becomes a werewolf. And when it becomes day, anything that can become a human becomes a human. We kind of built it into Day-Night so that it was just, oh, well, you know, the act of night turns things into werewolves. So even if your card didn't say that, it would turn you into werewolves. But it added text, and they're like, well, the werewolves already kind of say that, the old werewolves, so maybe we'll just leave them be. But I did go to the rules manager at the time, and I said, okay, so if we don't make that change, could we just errata all the old werewolves so they all work the same? And the rules manager said, yeah, we could do that. So it turns out, by the time the set would get to the final part of the product, a year later, the rules managers had changed, the rules manager there hadn't promised that to me. Anyway, so, and now did that change happen? Also, originally we had text that made it go away when there was nothing that cared about it. But that was extra text again that got added to the card, so they took that off. And so the card now can sit around, and there's things that, like, you sort of have to keep tracking, because maybe if I play a werewolf or something, you know, it needs to come in on its night form. And so, like, it just made the situation where you were tracking things that often didn't matter, and there was inconsistency. And anyway, it's a good example how sometimes that the pure idea is good, but a lot of the executions and the way you have to make the set, that a lot of the art of making magic mechanics is finding them down to the cleanest version, and sometimes the cleanest version is problematic unto itself. That sometimes when you make the simplest version of something, it itself causes problems. And that was a problem, I think, with Day Knight. Not that Day Knight in a vacuum is bad. There's some cool ideas to it, but just the actual sort of the way it ended up playing out and how we had to write it on the card, it just did a lot of things. Like, I'm not a big fan of inconsistency. I'm not a big fan of making you waste your time if it's not going to matter most of the time. And Day Knight can do all that. So that is why Day Knight is number 6. Anyway, guys, I'm now at work, so I will finish the rest of this next time. But as I'm at work, we all know what that means. It means the end of my drive to work. So instead of talking magic, it's time for me to be making magic. I'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.
To work. So instead of talking magic, it's time for me to make it magic. I'll see you all next time.